Hello and welcome to Skeleton Songs.
Hello.
We're doing a special one this week. We're doing one where I actually don't know anything about the topic, so you're in safe hands.
So what happened here was I said many years ago now, because we had a bit of a hiatus. We edit that out because we're not allowed to mention the hiatus, are we?
Yeah, we'll definitely edit this. We will edit it to make us sound clever. And perfect.
We got distracted making Book of Hours, so it wasn't actually a bit of years, was it? It was like a year we didn't make any podcasts.
I think it was 2 years, actually.
Okay. Well, we were very busy. Anyway.
Thanks for reminding them.
Truth and journalism. I'm not a journalist, though. I'm a dreamweaver.
Now, that's interesting that you mention.
Go on.
Author, visionary, dreamweaver, plus actor. That, if you haven't any idea what I'm talking about, is one of my favourite lines from a totally obscure British drama called Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. That is a send-up of a lot of kind of medical 80s dramas at the time, and is mad and fantastic. So I urge you to go and see it if you haven't.
I think it's worth very briefly talking about this, because Dark Place is not what you plan to talk about, but it is cool Skeleton Song stuff.
Next episode, I'm totally bringing a kazoo.
So Garth Marenghi is notionally a sort of bargain basement, but very successful horror author. What's his favourite? Our favourite is quotes, Lady Bevan?
Well, the one I just gave.
No, I think the other one. One of the very few authors.
Oh yeah, I'm one of the
who's
very
written more books than he's read.
Yeah, he says that very proudly. The whole setup is that there is an author who perhaps thinks better of himself than he deserves to, talking about his project, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, which is explicit homage, if anyone listening has watched things like Diagnosis Murder, that I loved when I was younger, and he thinks it's great, and we see clips of it, and then it's juxtaposed with the author talking about it, as well as some of the other actors. But yeah.
Anyway, the point is, Lottie made me watch Dark Place a couple of years ago, and she really had me sort of push me through the first episode at gunpoint, because she sometimes makes me watch all sorts of rubbish. And
I introduce you to Due South, okay? You owe me.
She sometimes makes me watch all sorts of rubbish, and sometimes she makes you watch Due South. And the whole point about Garth Marenghi, one of the points, is the production values are very much those of early 80s British TV, which were dreadful to the point of sometimes being physically painful. So I had to get past that initial thing of, I know it's supposed to be shit, but it's shit. But actually, once you know it's supposed to be shit, it's superb and intentionally so.
It's very funny.
Anyway, what we're here to talk about today is probably the penultimate episode of Magic in Literature. Because when we first started talking about it 2 years ago, I thought there's lots of meat on the bone here. But we realised, ultimately, there's only so many books that have something interesting to say about magic that both Lottie and I have read.
Well, and also specifically, a lot of books obviously have magic in them, but there are much fewer books that talk about the system of magic or
That's
go
what
into
I mean,
how
yeah.
it actually works. I just don't want people here to think that we've totally forgotten about the entire fantasy subgenre.
No.
But if you think, I mean, maybe you have some good ideas for books that we haven't read ourselves, but certainly when we were thinking, actually we can think of tons that are magical, but few that have particularly noteworthy systems of magic.
That we have both read. And one person did actually write in, hello, and say, you folks should totally do Susanna Harker. Susanna Harker? Susanna Clark?
No, Susanna Clark.
Clark.
One of my favourite authors.
Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norton.
She's so great.
Which we have both read and do both love. So that'd probably be the penultimate one. We might do Le Guin as well, because she's obviously...
I think we should, just out of, like, honour.
Yeah.
Le Guin needs one of her own.
Yeah, probably.
This
week, so I'm going to read an excerpt, and a small number of you may recognise it, and a slightly larger number of you may be able to identify the author. Fairies are halflings, like trolls, falloys, ogres and goblins, and unlike merihues, sandestines, quists and darklings. Merihues and sandestines both may manifest human semblance, but the occasion is one of caprice, and always fugitive. Quists are always as they are, and darklings prefer only to hint of their presence. So this is Jack Vance.
That's great.
This is from his Lyonesse series, which is a sort of, not even really quasi-historical, fantasy, allegedly set in the Sunken Lands off the coast of Cornwall. And there's, I think, four glossaries. There are, I'm looking at it, there's three glossaries at the end of the first Lyonesse book, because Vance was prodigious in almost every sense of the word. He wrote somewhere between 60 and 90 books.
I saw that.
Over the course of his almost 100-year life.
But he started quite late, didn't he? That was the real
kicker. He did. And this is something I think we'll probably want to get back to, is his extraordinary life.
Mm.
But one of the things about Vance is he just sort of sat down and poured out something that felt like it had always been there. So obviously this is invented, right? There's some words there which he's brought in from traditional mythology, like fairies and goblins. There's some that he has invented that have some sort of derivation, like sandestines, which suggests something like without destiny. And there's other words. This is one of his particular genius qualities that sound like real words in English, but as far as I can tell, totally invented, like merihew or quist. Yeah. And he's got this really clear structure. So you've got this hierarchy, right? We've got fairies are like these other things, but they're different from them. So as soon as you say they're like these other things, which you also haven't heard of, you suggest some authority and you suggest a sort of a larger world without needing to go into the details. And then he goes on, fairies, like the other halflings, are functionally hybrids with varying proportions of earth stuff. With the passage of time, the proportion of earth stuff increases, if only through the ingestion of air and water, although occasional coition of man and halfling hastens the process. As the halfling becomes heavy with earth stuff, it converges towards humanity and loses some or all of its magic. So again, there, we've got a system. We've got this sort of same sense of somebody lecturing to you so they know what they're talking about. He gets through a lot of information in a very few words. There's not much feeling of show rather than tell rather than show here, even though there's no story telling you, because we've got some sort of stakes and some story process set up. We've got this thing that intuitively makes sense, that fairies are a sort of mixture of airy and earthy. It's pretty novel. I mean, you know, you can trace it back to like Renaissance magic and stuff, but this is a particular idea I haven't heard of. You've got this account of how things change. You've got the suggestion that fairies having sex with humans is actually perilous for fairies, which is the first time I come across that. And the next paragraph he talks about how what happens when a fairy becomes too lumpy and earthy. It's driven out from the fairy mound and it's forced to live among humanity with a few fairy powers.
That's great.
So there's that's it, two freaking paragraphs.
How is he so inventive?
Well, let's talk about his life.
Yes, and then we can talk about, I hadn't realised that there's a big thing that gamers are interested in.
Oh, yes.
He had a particular impact on. And I should say, the reason I said at the start of the episode is that I don't know what I'm talking about here, is that I've never read any Vance. I did, my English degree was very traditional, which meant that, you know, we did all the classics and it was all English, not American. And obviously Jack Vance is American. And as far as my course was concerned, nobody has written a book since 1945. That's where the course stopped. And this Jack Vance supposed author is writing 60 to 90 books in America in the 1960s onwards.
I loved Vance from sort of the age of 13 onwards. And oddly enough, Lottie, to prep for this, had a quick squiz around the internet for what she could find. She looked at the Wikipedia entry of Vance and found that at the bottom...
Although that's not the sum total of our...
No, indeed. Had a quick squiz around the internet, of which this was one component.
Thank you.
And I believe you found Fauna London listed as one of the works that had been...
It was really weird, yeah. I read the whole thing.
Fauna London was my first game, for those of you who are unaware of the connection.
Yeah, it was very odd. It's sort of like reading a Wikipedia article about, I don't know, Obama, at the bottom, someone mentioning your sibling.
Yeah.
It's a bit, oh... Okay.
So, in fact, if you still play Fallen London, I assume it's still in there. There is an opportunity card which crops up very occasionally, which I put in myself in 2013, which was the year that Jack Vance died, age 96.
Good innings.
And you meet a stranger who has coloured, apparently semi-precious stones looping around their head in an orbit, and they say something Vancean to you. And then there's some sort of dedicational lines of you know, R.I.P. Jack Vance, without whom there would be fewer colours in Fallen London.
Aww,
the things looping around his head are iron stones, which is another of Vance's invented words. Iron stones made it into the other thing we'll talk about in a bit. But in the original context they come up, they're spelled I-O-U-N, but they're always spelled out in capitals for no reason that's ever explained. Iawn stones. Now, I had a Welsh friend who always found it hilarious because da iawn in Welsh means very good, but it's in a sort of, that's grand sort of way.
so the iawn stones.
Yeah.
And just for schmucks like me who haven't read Vance, you said Vancian. Does he have a particular style, or is it just if you read him, you know?
Like, he does. I mean, he's the man for whom the word inimitable was coined. Vance
doesn't help.
I'm getting there, but I paused for the mold, and you leapt in because you were vigorous. I'm almost falling into a Vancian pattern there. So he's got a tremendous vocabulary. He's very evocative. He's very good on detail, and he, in particular, in his fantasy stuff and other stuff as well, people adopt a register which is often very funny, very erudite, and rather over the top. A favourite line I remember from one of his Dying Earth books is there's a sort of disputation between two characters who are competing for the same post of supercargo on a ship. And one of them says to the other something like, I'm prepared to offer myself for the post since my rival's nostrils are drooping and elongated, which inclines a tendency to seasickness. And his rival replies, Krubel is an acute gentleman. I would rate him an applicant of fair to excellent quality and urge you to ignore his long, spatulate fingers, which I last noticed on Larkin the Baby Stealer. There is a significant difference between Larkin and Krubel after all. Larkin has been hanged, and Krubel has not been hanged. So you get this very mannered thing that often you have to wait a second for the laugh to catch up with you at the end of the sentence.
It's Wildian, that.
It is Wildian, and one of his explicit influences, which you would not have expected to find.
I know what it was.
Go on.
It Woodhouse.
It was.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that.
But imagine what I just said coming out of the mouth of Jeeves. You can
totally see it. No, yeah. It's true.
There's
it's true.
I remember the same conversation because some of this stuff sticks with you and there's sort of continuing dispute. Krubel, our hero, says something particularly acute, and his rival sort of responds and says, Krubel's qualities are clearly excellent, and I suppose you must choose him for the position. All I can offer in by way of substitute is my own honesty, diligence, experience, and the indisputable fact that I'm a dignified citizen of the area, not a fox-faced vagabond with an over-fancy hat. And listen to the prosody of that at the end. Fox-faced vagabond with an over-fancy hat.
No, only when someone with your diction could say that. So,
but that, again, is I've talked so many times about prosody in my writing, and that I realised, you know, Vance was one of the people I took that from. You have a lot of sort of up and down spondy stuff at the end of the sentence, and it's really effective, especially as a bit of a payoff to a gag, because it forces you to sort of weave your way in and out like you're slaloming, and it slows you down, especially if you're reading out loud, but even if you're thinking it. So it really works.
That's great. I was surprised to find out how comic he was, because I mean, this is probably an absolute unfair thing to say about an entire genre of literature, the fantasy genre, but my understanding was that like fantasy was always kind of like serious, which is probably Tolkien's fault. Not that Tolkien has ever done anything wrong in his life, he's an angel amongst us, but obviously that kind of high fantasy is very serious and there are moments of levity, but I wouldn't describe any bit really as sort of comic. Whereas when I was reading about Vance, I was really surprised to see that like comedy is clearly really intrinsic to his stuff.
You're right, and I think again he wrote so many books that it covered an enormous range. He wrote a whole bunch of space opera as well, which is less comic but still often quite comic. He wrote some noir stuff I think early on, and some whodunits. He wrote some Ellery Queen novels, because you know that Ellery Queen is a pseudonym. But the stuff he's best known for, things like Leoness and the Dying Earth, are fantasy with a capital F, possibly in block capitals, certainly with serifs, very likely in gold leaf or a calcum leaf. And they often got really dark themes. There's a story which I think I read you once. This is your one experience of the Vance.
Oh, this isn't the guy with the eyes.
This is the guy with the eyes.
Yes.
Chun the Unavoidable.
He was horrible.
I won't spoil Chun the Unavoidable for those of you who've
But what you're thinking is basically true. Like, it's really upsetting and great.
Yeah.
And now I can see how inventive it was, because at the time I thought I'd never really heard anything like that. It was a short story, right?
Yes, yeah. It was from the Dying Earth, which was a collection of short stories set when the world is, as you might expect, moribund.
Is it dying?
Yeah. Hmm. So you've got this darkening sun that occasionally flickers and might go out, and you've got sort of 1,000 civilizations have come and gone, and people are living in the ruins. But it's this very ripe Byzantine, richly coloured sort of environment. And it's gothic, and it draws a lot from sort of pulp authors, people like Rice Burroughs. And I think, again, you look at the Dying Earth, and you look at the planetary romances set on Mars with the dying planet, there's an obvious lineage there. But those tended to be much more serious than Vance, who keeps coming back to the Woodhousian rhythm.
And, I mean, obviously I love humour, so that's good for him. I'm pleased
with
that.
I've heard you make jokes.
I have been known occasionally.
Despite being a lady.
And sometimes they're funny. I mean, who'd have thought? But in terms of the magic, because we talked a lot about the sci-fi stuff, and if you didn't know, you might think that he was a kind of SF author and you could expect science and fiction put together. But I understand that he actually lent more into kind of, I don't know, like human magic rather than sort of pew-pew wizards, although I think he did have a famous wizard character, but I think it was a bit more kind of psionic power. And I know that he didn't do robots. So what's, tell me about magic.
What you said was not entirely wrong.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, he is making the face that he makes when what he wants to do is call me an effing idiot, but he is polite and loves me and therefore will not do that. But clearly I have made an error. So now we watch and see how the creature in his natural habitat deals with this.
It's really unfair to suggest you made an error, because you didn't, because you haven't read the books, so, you know.
And yet you still look in pain. Go on, say what he'd actually like.
Well, no, so
I was just setting you up.
So I know, that's why I feel extra bad.
And now you've hung a lantern on it and everyone's like, oh, Lottie's a moron.
But the lantern's so pretty. Look at it twinkle in the twilight.
That's so sexist.
So I read that bit of Vancian taxonomy about fairies at the beginning.
Yes.
To give a sense of what he's very good at is sketching out quite quickly a system, so you've got some expectations and rules that you can deal with. And when 50 pages later you see somebody say, oh, you know, I've absorbed too much earth stuff, you're like, oh, I know what happens next, and I feel clever because I've done it. And you provide that internal consistency, which is very important for something like fantasy, because as soon as people can do magic means people can do anything at any point, then the story disintegrates into dream stuff.
I think you said something very salient in our last episode when you said something like, the problem with a magic system in fiction is you have to answer the question, if magic is in the world, why doesn't the President of the United States use it? And that's a really good shorthand of, like, can you explain why basically everyone isn't constantly, I don't know, rotating and on fire, which presumably is not the plot.
You're right, and that's the sort of outer ring of it. And then the inner ring of it is once you've established that Gandalf, to choose the sort of easy fantasy archetype, is a wizard, why cannot he make the Nazgul go away? Okay, because you have some rules. There's 9 of them and 1 of him. Mm. Fine. Why can Gandalf not use his arts throughout the early Fellowship story? Well, it's because he doesn't want to attract too much attention. Because if he starts waving his hands about and fire comes out while he's travelling with Frodo, then the enemy will be like, ooh, look at that.
I always wondered why I only had one spell. Because I grew up listening to the audio version of The Hobbit, which was on the radio, which my parents recorded for me on audio cassette, because you could record the radio back in the 1,000 years old that I am. And he only ever said one spell. It was the same thing whenever he did anything, whether it was, you know, set fire to the wargs or, like, illuminate the hobbit hole so they could all see the map. He would go, now in a dryer tarmen. And that was it. But no matter what, it could have been him making toast or killing a dragon. It was the same spell. Presumably that was dramatic license rather than a specific Tolkien point.
I think probably it's...
I mean, it sounds cool.
I don't remember the phrase, but it's probably like some Quenya or something. And they made the actor learn this. And he's like, after the first phrase, like, this is a made-up language. And
I'm
from the RSC, you know. Can't we just re-loop it? I was in Lear. Listen, talk about dark magic. We won't talk about magic. Dark magic. A lot of you refuse to believe this happened, but if you're as old as me, you might recall it. So back in the day, computers didn't have disk drives. We had to load programs in them by putting a cassette tape in a tape recorder, connect to the computer, and pressing play. And you could hear it going. So it's
I absolutely refuse to believe this.
So, you know, manifested an acoustic signal. We also didn't have the internet. The closest thing we had to the internet was radio and TV. So what the BBC would do very late at night is they would actually broadcast simple software over the analogue radio
channel.
And my mum would get up, because, you know, I was like 12 or something, and my mum would get up after I'd gone to bed when it was come on, and she'd go into the living room and she'd turn on the radio and she'd and so she'd know the time had come. Oh, she'd probably be already too late at that point. But
I was going to say, you can't record
No, you can't. So she'd do it. She'd be like, she'd press record on the
tape recorder. And not that I believe this.
And then the quality was sort of just about good enough that I could pop this into my tape recorder of my BBC.
It's just like if you told me that, you know, in the olden days you used to make bread by sacrificing a dog. I just don't believe there's any correlation between audio.
Which brings us back to the inner ring, because if you, I said you could make bread by sacrificing a dog, then
which to be clear we condemn. Don't kill a dog.
Don't sacrifice dogs for any reason.
No.
Even if they're really mean and have bitten you. And you can't make bread out of them.
Doesn't work, kids.
but if you knew, for example, that the dogs were the sacred animals of the fungus god.
Mm. I definitely wouldn't kill them then.
But then if you were wanting to make good bread, then it would immediately make sense if somebody said, as a bit of a story, throw a storyline, you know, he sacrificed a dog to make sure that the bread was free of fungus because he didn't bring the taint on it or something.
Okay, well, you just ruined bread. Congratulations. Anything else you're going to destroy?
I don't think you want me to. So I'm not going to. And anyway, look, Vance rules magic. So he's very good at these sort of systematising things.
Yeah.
And I think a couple of things, three things that I can think of off the top of my head that he was really great at. One is that he'd very quickly sketch a system with very little work. And he wouldn't bother filling in all the details. You don't need all the details filled in. This is the thing about plumbing. If you go through every single detail, then
you always say this.
Yeah, well, because when you get to a certain point, the details stop being interesting, and also the whole thing is made up anyway. You know, I unless you actually are reflecting magic work in the real world, which is not a common occurrence, then at some point you have to say, well, why isn't this thing the same thing as the other? Well, because I made it up, and it doesn't work anyway. So Vance is good at stopping short of that. A lot of his stuff was kind of was innovative. You read a lot of Vance, you think there's nothing been done before or after quite like this. Even
that's
in
such
the 50s
an amazing thing
it really
to say
is.
About somebody.
You know, there's a whole sequence I think about sometimes when I think about this in one of the Dying Earth books, Google Saga, where our protagonist, who's a picaro, a rogue, on a wandering adventure. In the first Kugel book, he's an outright prick. He's a really unsympathetic character. He's quite cruel. And Vance tones him down for the second book, which is much more fun. But he happens upon this little settlement where the social structure is as follows. The women basically run the show, and the men are trophy pieces. And the way that men are trophy pieces is they sit on top of columns, absorbing the healthful rays of the sunlight, and the most important women of the village, well, it's notion their husbands are important, have the tallest columns where the air is cleanest and the rays are strongest. And how do you get these columns up? Well, it so happens that there is somebody living locally who has magic boot polish.
What?
He thinks this is because of his talisman, but he's actually got magic boot polish as well. And what he does is he can kick one of these big stones left over from a huge temple that's fallen to bits nearby, and the stone gradually briefly becomes weightless. It can be lofted into the air to put on top of a column. And that's how the columns are built. They're all built of this ancient temple nearby. It was Dying Earth, right? Remnants of previous times. And so this guy's got a good racket going, because the ladies in the village come out and say, oh, can you put a stone on top of my husband's column? The other ladies in the village come out and say, oh, can you put another stone on top of my husband's mm-hmm. column? And you know, it's still a lot of work to drag the stones up from the wreckage, even when they're sort of almost weightless. So when Kugel gets involved, he thinks of a new twist on the racket. He thinks, well, what these ladies care about is the stones, that the one column is higher than another. So rather than need to go down to the temple and get a bunch more stones,
he's going to take them all.
We could just quietly take the bottom stone out of the column.
Kugel.
So they're all the same height. And then we could put one of those stones on top. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the village women start catching on and blackmailing them, and it becomes a whole a plot thing. But how about that as a sort of odd little social commentary, a really original thing? And it's a chapter in this book. So wildly original. So really original, very good at systematising stuff with a sketch or two, and great at coining words that sound like words. And you know, obviously, why
it speaks to you.
It does speak to me. And this is one of my goals when I've invented words for games or text, has been to try to make things that sound like they would fit in your mouth and sound like they've actually been knocked about between the sort of pebbles of languages for a couple of centuries. And Vance is one of the people I've looked to for a sense of how to do that.
So where does his magic come from then? Because he's good at systems, I get, and that there is some sort of thought through believable way that magic exists in a world and therefore doesn't allow everybody to do magic all the time. But what is it, his magic?
Well, when I say his magic, I've set it up a bit as suggesting this sort of wand system. And actually, when people talk about Vancian magic, they talk about the way magic works for most of the dying earth. And even then, there's lots of different kinds of magic. So the magic boot polish that allows you to get money from old ladies putting their husbands on pillars isn't any part of it.
But the free business idea.
The particular thing is. And some of you who don't already know the connection, some of you will know the connection, but some of you who don't will recognise the connection.
I know
now.
What you're going to say.
You do. So a Vancian magician, when he wants to learn some spells that can be done on the fly, not as ritual, he will memorise them. And you can usually only store, most people install like one spell in their mind. So they could turn invisible or have a fiery spray that lances their enemy with points of ladylike light, and the top end magicians
two types of magic
could do two or three, and some few people could do four or five.
Okay,
so you have to choose up front which spells you memorize, and then each of them are a shot, because once you say the words are in your mind, mm-hmm. it's gone from memory. You have to re-memorize it the next day. And this, of course, is how in the beginning all D&D magic worked. And now you get all this newfangled and very frickin' sensible stuff with sorcerers who can cast spells on the fly.
Okay, sorry, so that is why Gandalf only has one spell. We figured it out.
But imagine if he had, every time he said that, had to go and memorise the lines again.
Well,
afterwards.
He does go, doesn't he? He's, I was doing something else out of
but
the sight
the
of
point
the
point is, to the best of my knowledge, this is an entirely advanced innovation. He didn't come
it's
out
very weird.
It's very weird.
I wish they said it in D&D, because when I came to D&D, and it was like, oh, choose your spell, and then you can only use it. Well, I was like, what?
Well, they do say memorise. But it's not really clear why. And Vance does a lot with the prose here. He has all these descriptions of like this sort of spell writhing powerfully on the page. And you have to sort of cram it in through your eyes and sort of subdue it in your head.
Interesting.
Now, I'm going to tell you something that I think you'll like, that I've literally only made a connection with now. So the thing about Vance that you might have read as well. That I think might have had some part in this. So you've got this real sense of this knowledge on the page that you have to sort of struggle into your brain, and then by the next day it's freaking gone, you have to learn it all over again. So Vance, he went through a whole bunch of careers in his early life.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And he tried, I think he wanted to join the intelligence services or the diplomatic corps or something in the US. So he tried to learn Japanese.
Yeah, I saw this.
And he couldn't fathom it. He failed the test and gave up. So I wonder if...
this is a nod to how difficult Japanese is.
Exactly, or that he had.
I don't believe that he can.
Well, not Japanese.
I think
not
maybe
Japanese specifically. That he had, this sense of, because I think when you are learning a language, especially one in an unfamiliar alphabet, you really do sometimes feel like you're fighting something with a lot of limbs.
Yeah.
So that's all. I'm not saying he's particularly rude about Japanese.
No, it wasn't that. I just think that somebody who is obviously so intelligent and also is quite linguistically minded because of all his etymology and his sort of thought systematizing that we've just talked about, I think there was something else going on as to why he didn't complete his Japanese course. I suspect he was busy doing other things. And whether that was ladies or whether that was, I don't know, a sudden interest in the banjo, which is a genuine thing that he had, to be clear. I'm not making that up.
And the kazoo, I believe.
Oh, it was so much more. So it was the cornet. It was the jazz banjo. It was the kazoo. So if anyone's read any Vance, apparently music is often a motif he comes back to, because he clearly was a very talented musician.
Often with weird instruments, which again, he's obviously invented.
Love the banjo.
But he'll invent some instrument and give it a name.
Oh, right, okay.
But it's the kind of thing that somebody who's probably played a bunch of instruments would think, oh, you know, you could put three strings here. Well, I don't know, it's a guitar, but it's upside down. So the thing about his early life I rediscovered and discovered today is he grew up quite wealthy. His family had money and a big house, and then so he grew up reading voraciously.
His mother's library apparently was her who was the particular.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was his mum.
So he grows up surrounded by all this pulp stuff that he references later and Navigate and reading very widely and reading Woodhouse. And then the family runs out of money, so he has to go and earn a living.
It's the Great Depression, wasn't it?
And yeah, of course, I made that connection.
Bad times.
So he makes a living.
Clues in the name.
All these. Well, it's called the Great Depression. It's not called the Rubbish Depression.
They're not British,
the
darling.
The Great Depression.
It's American. It's literally what they do.
We're
going to have a depression. It's going to be the best depression we've ever had.
We had a mediocre depression over here.
Yeah,
on the Soviet
it was a bit rubbish.
But he works in shipyards. He works as a rigger. He works as an electrician.
I liked him when he was a bellhop.
A bellhop. He spends some time in the Merchant Navy, and I think the Merchant Navy stuff is the thing I knew that shows up most readily later.
Because apparently, a lot of sailing is very important.
Sailing is very important. There's lots of ships and spaceships in his books. There's a lot of travel, and there's a lot of people coming ashore in unusual places and having to learn the customs. And I always thought, if you're a merchant marine in the 1950s, before there's much in the way of colour photography or television.
Do you know how he got into the Navy? Did you see this?
No.
This is very Kugel, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
This is very Kugel of him. So he, I think, was born with fairly poor eyesight. So when he initially finished whatever it was he was doing and was an adult, it was 1942, which meant he might well have been called up in the army, but he wasn't because his eyesight was too poor to call him up automatically. But he did want to join the Navy, ultimately, he went on to do. And he did this by memorising an eye chart.
No.
He literally did. That's how he got in. He shouldn't have been in, but he just memorised what it was, said all the letters, and the person was like, yeah, no problem, 2020.
And you're right, that is exactly Kugel. That's the whole...
Because he's called Kugel the Clever, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm delighted you didn't know that.
I didn't, but I did know at the other end of the story that Vance... So he was writing for years before he was successful. He was like 1970 or something, I think.
It was 62-ish, I think, was the books that I first saw. When he
But he got published before then.
Oh, right, sorry. But he didn't get successful into the 70s.
Exactly. So he was still doing other trades. Apparently he built or part-built a whole house for his family in San Francisco, where he's from. And like carved the ceiling himself, and I thought when I read that there's a lot of wood carving, and again a lot of sort of manual trades in.
Oh, that was it. He got into pottery for a bit. So there's something called the Kilns of Smorgasbord. One of his books is called
The Kilns of Smorgasbord.
Yes, officially it's just been discovered. It says over here that we just discovered a new Vance manuscript, The Kilns of Smorgasbord, and it's all about his interest in pottery. So maybe he had ADHD.
I don't know what to believe anymore. And not after the eye test thing.
It's good,
but I know that he owned a bunch of ships. He owned a bunch of ships, makes him sound like a pirate. No, I mean,
imagine he lived in a cave with a mermaid?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. He had a series of pleasure boats that he...
That makes it sound so much worse.
It does make it sound worse. Right, look, he had yachts and things, but they were like small yachts, and he didn't do anything all at the same time.
He liked going out for a sail.
He liked going out for a sail, but his eyesight was always iffy.
Yeah.
And he ended up having to give up sailing because his eyesight was
yeah, he was, I think right behind me was 80, he was medically blind.
Was he?
So his last book, actually, another fun fact, his last book was written with the help of software that was specifically written for him because he couldn't actually type.
If I remember correctly, his last book was called Night Lamp.
Maybe that's the one.
That's the biggest. It was. I remember it being a new Vance when I was younger, and I remember being excited, and I remember it wasn't his best, but you know, he was over 90 by that point. And anyway, the point is, I think it's unusual to have somebody who comes across as so prodigious and so innovative. And I think one of the ways you do it is by growing up surrounded by books and reading like a bastard until the knowledge comes out of your ears, and then losing all your money and have to work on a whole variety of trades.
Yeah, I think he had to drop out
having
of
a whole variety of life experiences.
College to work. That was it. He was doing some sort of higher education when the financial disaster hit. So he had to drop out, have some proper careers. And he said something poignant about he went from being a sort of useless intellectual over a period of about 3 years to becoming a sort of Renaissance man, because suddenly he'd been a carpenter and this and that, and he'd done everything, and he obviously wasn't being rude about intellectuals, because he clearly was one and he loved reading more than anything. But yeah, I agree, it really obviously did something interesting to him. And I love people who've had really complicated lives. My favourite thing is people who've kind of done something a bit different than the path that is laying down before us. And particularly when it comes to authors, I mean, one of my favourite authors of all time is Conrad. I think he's one of the best writers I've ever read. And when I found out that he wasn't even a first language English speaker, I think that has a real interesting impact. Same with Mervyn Peake, the Gormenghast guy, as he's known to his friends. The fact that he obviously was first language English, but he'd also learned Chinese and been brought up in a sort of awareness of Chinese culture at a very young age that most Western authors don't automatically have. And I think that once you know that, you can see it a bit in his work, and it just makes it a bit different and weird and interesting.
I think I've said this before, that Conrad and Nabokov, both of whom were not first language English but wrote masterfully in English, I feel like there is some analytical distance they have from the prose that isn't really available to native English speakers, especially when it comes to describing environments. But it's so hard to know whether I'd feel that way if I didn't already know about their background, whether I'm imagining it. But the point you made earlier, that maybe the reason Jack Vance didn't learn Japanese was not his deficiency as a linguist, but maybe his deficiency as somebody who's keeping his mind on one thing, doesn't sound unreasonable.
Because I would not be, you know, we mentioned the conspiracy theory earlier in this episode that computers apparently made of angel sounds or some nonsense. And I would also believe a conspiracy theory that told me that Jack Vance was actually three men in a suit, because the amount of stuff he managed to cram into one life is three people's lives at least. It's astonishing.
It really makes me feel wildly inadequate.
I know, most of us were very lazy. Like, what are we doing tonight? I'm cooking a chili. Well, Jack Vance wrote 8 novels before lunch.
He lived all over the world as well. He and his wife just decided they wanted to live in different places for a year at a time. So they kept going up and going to Italy or Polynesia or
wherever. That's so cool. Did they have kids?
I think so.
And the kids just came
I don't know if he had kids at the time.
That's amazing.
But the whole connection, the magic system thing, this very unusual sense that you have to cram spells into your brain and then you one-shot them, and they usually have a big dramatic effect.
That is so odd.
It is so odd. And it is one of those quirks of history as a game designer, a game scholar, that it ended up being the foundational assumption about D&D magic.
Mm.
And it's interesting as well seeing some of the ways that changed when it went into D&D. So Vancian spells, the ones you actually have to learn rather than sort of the techniques you use to make magic boot polish or grow creatures in your vats or whatever, they all tend to be pretty significant. It's not like you cast a spell and now you're a bit better at carpentry for an hour, everything in the room glows slightly blue. It'll be like the call to the violent cloud. And this is one of the other things that went into D&D quite directly. Vance, very good at names, very good at evocative phrases. So the idea of spells being called things like the call to the violent cloud
rather than
Fandral's Deceptor,
make a storm.
So you've got things like Nistal's Mystic Aura or Bigby's Grasping Hand are the more interesting D&D spells. But then of course what quite quickly went to was a lot of other D&D spells, this is still true now, but I'm talking about literal first ed Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, so if some of it's not accurate in 5th ed, then I'm a creature out of deep time. Fireball, for example.
It's not the most evocative name.
No.
Quite descriptive.
Or sleep. And I don't know to what extent it's just because they ran out of creative energy, because there's somebody who's had to sit in front of a spreadsheet full of like 280 blank lines that they need to fill in with prose. I sympathise. And how much of it is just practicality? Because if every time you have to say, oh, do you want to cast Nistel's blinding nimbus, or Bigby's incandescent fulgency, then what you might want to say is, do you want to cast blind or fireball?
There's a real irony there, because you're saying that Vance's magic system at its sort of height is particularly about how difficult it is to wrangle magic, and how you have to, you can only cram one spell in your head and then it sort of slithers out again as soon as you're not looking. And the fact that the actual humans who are actually engaging with this in D&D don't want to cram things in their head, they want to be able to say fireball. It's I'm not hating on people who play D&D here at all. I'm just saying it's a real kind of nod to human nature.
In
fiction, it's fine to say, oh, magic's very difficult to fit in. But if you want to play a magic person, you don't want that. You don't want it to be harsh.
This is something, you're right. This is something very constant at the moment, because one of the... In Book of Hours, I wanted to have a whole sort of recondite, complicated series of things where people really had to sort of work it out by bit.
And the spreadsheets that our players make prove
so
that
this is
succeeded.
The thing. I think if I made Book of Hours I probably have a third as many skills because I should have clocked this by now after 14 years of game design, but I didn't really think that people would feel constrained to grab all the skills, but of course they flipping did. And then you've got too many skills to easily organise. And the thing about having something really recognised that actually requires you, one of the people who likes it, who actually wanted me not to put in the crafting helper in the game, said, because when I've memorised it all and it feels, you know, I'm like, oh, I could put this one in here. I feel like a wizard in a tower.
Yeah.
The exact words they use. Yeah. They really get the sense of having mastered it. It's the same thing at the very opposite end of game budgets that you get in Bloodborne after you spent 20 hours working out to defeat this boss. You really get a sense of mastery.
Yeah.
But of course, a lot of people don't want this. So the Book of Hours got very good reviews on Steam. But
thank you. But love the reviews.
Overwhelmingly, the bad reviews say things like, this game doesn't respect the player's time, or lol, I'm not smart enough for it. It doesn't connect up enough for
that's funny.
So I think that you do get this thing where you turn the dial up and down, and I always tend to turn the dial farther than most designers. Like Sunless Sea, notoriously, the boat is probably too slow, but if it had been too fast...
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Sunless Sea... Well, no, because I've said this in print before. Sunless Sea, the boat is probably too slow, but I've always said the boat stays slow, goes on my gravestone, because I think given a bit more time and balance, you could have found a slightly sweeter spot where it was a little bit faster. But it would have ended up being zippy and slight if it had been too fast.
Exactly.
And the people who still, years after I left the company, leave reviews on Sun and Sea saying, I just love the sort of chill feeling of chugging along in the dark with the music, wouldn't get that. It also wouldn't get the reviews of people saying, for God's sake, I just want to get to the island that's got the cow on and finish the thing, and I can't save and it's annoying.
Yeah.
So you do some of... There's often a third way. There's often a way to reconcile these things and make it work, solve both those problems, but often you choose your poison. I've said before, design is moving the pain around, which brings it back to D&D, and you're right, you know, they move the pain around, and I think honestly they did, especially considering it was the first time anybody had written a role-playing game system. They did a bang-up job. It's still...
I mean, they're doing all right, aren't they?
Well, I mean, they're dead now, but...
Well, not them. I meant the IP.
The IP is doing all right. No, I loathed the D&D magic system when I was a 20-something role player playing things like Ars Magica and homebrew games and whatnot. I was like, ugh, it's so flavourless and it makes no sense. Why do they pick this one paradigm for Vance, who's great, but there's a... But at the time, it was really easy to understand. You didn't have to count up magic points. You didn't have to learn difficult mechanisms. You just had to look at the table and it said you can learn 5 first level and 3 second level and 1/3 level spell. But also, it's about as flavourful as a trencher of bread beneath the actual meal. And one of the things about advancing spells, they tend to be significant one-shots. The fact that you've got 4 spells in a day, enough to get you through a short story. But if you're playing a 5-hour dungeon crawl, then 4 spells doesn't get you very fast. And notoriously, first level D&D magic users are hilarious because they've got D4 hit points. If you're playing original D&D, you can literally end up with 1 hit point. So if a kobold pokes you in the chest with a sufficiently fierce pot of yogurt, it'll kill you.
Okay, well, this is a touchy subject at the minute, because I have recently started replaying Disco Elysium. And right, I'm really hurt by this. I've actually not played the game since this happened, and it happened last week because I'm still in a fight with it. I started playing as, I think, the intellectual main character, that you can choose your kind of starting stats, which meant that I was obviously quite clever, but I had very limited, I think, physical and... Anyway, I can't remember. Some limited, basically, your useless level 1 magic user stats. And I literally got killed about 3 hours in because a child was mean to me in conversation. That is a thing that literally happened to me.
Well, I'll take you away from this. Your sword was a kid beat you up.
Your kid says some pretty mean things to me.
She does. She
doesn't mean to, but she does. She's got... The Kennedys have particularly exceptional hair as a family. This is a real thing. And the Bevans...
Oh, come on. I know you're going to say it. It was years ago
yes,
now.
And
you're
I
still
will,
nursing
as
the
I die, I will remember these words. The Bevans have lovely, sleek, soft hair, but it is not the mighty beast that the Kennedys have. And one time I came back from the hairdressers, and Alexis's child was about 7 at the time, and she'd been told, you know, the previous few times you've seen Lottie's new hair, you've been a bit mean about it. You haven't meant to, but you said, "Ugh, that stinks," all words to that effect. So maybe you should just be a bit nice about it this time, even if you think it's horrible. And so I could see the little cogs turning in her tiny head as she sort of paused, and then she said, "I just feel sorry for you." And I was murdered. It was a murder.
Listen, just when we're talking game design, I have to tell very quickly the other kid's story from the other night, which is we were playing Unstable Unicorns, and my kid and I playing Unstable Unicorns with Lottie. Is always an exercise in different approaches to games, because, you know, Lottie's like, it's a car game and the unicorns
play
the funnels. And most importantly, I don't care. You know, you literally give it down. My kid...
She's a game designer in
training. She literally... Yeah, we found out the other day, she'd literally written out the names of all the cards and their details in her journal, so she could memorise them and strategise better. And we were playing, and Lottie was expostulating about that somebody cares too much about this. And I knew both of them well enough that I knew this would work. I turned, looked Lottie in the eyes and said to my kid, "Hey, how many nay," which are like cancellation, interrupt cards, "are there in the deck?" And Sonia said, without stopping to think about it, 13, I think. Turns out there are 14. She came back and apologised when she realised she got it wrong. And Lottie was immediately appalled, because the idea that Sonia would not only have memorised the cards, but would so clearly have memorised the cards that I'd be able to provoke that response.
It's some Matrix madness. It's just a totally different way of existing.
Anyway, Jack Vance.
Sorry, back D&D. To Jack.
The D&D systematised. The thing is, you've got to have your ship first level wizard who can cast sleep once, and that's it. They've got to have height of
battle.
It really is rubbish. And like, throw darts, because as a wizard, original D&D, you know, you can't wear armour. You're allowed to use a dagger, a quarterstaff, or throw darts. Point, point, point. And the fighters, you know, can't do anything interesting, but they keep on slugging. And then you need the power to keep increasing with the levels, and the fighters are sort of increase, you know, they get extra hit points and are better at smiting things every level. Original D&D, it's really that basic. And the wizards start getting the cool spells. So obviously...
So what level do they start getting the cool spells?
Well, if I'm correctly, at fifth level you can cast third level spells.
So they've got 4 whole levels of being rubbish.
Yes. And then, you know, Fireball is the game changer, because it's an area...
The Sam Gamgee of the party.
Yeah.
And ultimately they're the total backbone of everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and ultimately they pass the fighters. It's a tragedy, like children surpassing their parents, ultimately, you know. But presumably what Gygax did... or the other designers, was say, well, we want to give wizards these cool spells, but if you give them these cool spells at start, they'll just totally overshadow everyone else.
Mm.
So what we need to do is, at the first level, they get the crap spells, like fall asleep a bit, or detect magic. You know, you don't need to detect magic spell, that's your slot for the day at first level.
That is
that's
so
it,
rubbish.
It glows, is it? And then they sort of begin the other way. So Vance obviously designed... his system, to the extent that he designed a system at all, assuming that, you know, if you're a wizard, that means you're immediately a cool, powerful, interesting individual.
Mm.
And D&D, you can't immediately assume a wizard's a cool, powerful, interesting individual. Whereas, and this is one of the reasons why I fell in love with a game called Ars Magica, which I'm not sure it's still in print, at the age of about 19, they reinvented this, and they thought, well, it's very difficult to put wizards as cool, unique, mysterious individuals who spend all their time in books, in towns reading books and never go on adventures, in a game, because they don't go on adventures, they're not in the game.
You've literally just described Book of Outlets, but sure.
Well, again, a big influence on my work. And so what they did was, well, how if we redesigned a game around the idea that to be a wizard, you had basically to be a sort of academic with worse, even worse personal hygiene.
Hey.
Sorry, academic friends. What would the game look like? And they said, well, you know, first of all, we'd have a mechanic for study where you get rewarded for spending downtime, but you have to go out to find ingredients, and you get sort of three different tiers of characters which are shared around. We'll have troop style play rather than GM style play, because the people would take different turns playing the different characters, and really inventive, flawed but brilliant. And that goes back much more towards the Vancian idea of the wizard as somebody who's living in a manse with their cucurbit and their components, even though the system in Ars Magica is totally unrelated to anything Vancian in any way. One more D&D fact for you, and this is really for you. If I were to say to you Dromacraft,
yeah,
does that mean anything to you?
I assume it would mean made by dwarves.
You would, because you your region there is Skyrim, right?
The drama. Yeah.
So
is that wrong?
Well, I don't think it is wrong, and in fact, I think it's another interesting point I hadn't thought of. Dromacraft is an old English word that I'm probably pronouncing wrong that means magic spell weaving. And because, again, you know, Gygax was obviously a sort of, I don't know if he was actually an autodidact or had an unusual education, but he was very bitty. He was very erudite in some ways and completely sort of shut in and blank in others. And so they happened to pick the Vancian approach, which was interesting, other things. And he also fell in love with this word Dwoma, which he took from the Old English Dwoma. I don't think Dwoma is still a word in English, but a really obscure one. So he used it to mean like magical aura or magic or enchantment. The Dwoma on this sword is of such intensity.
And that's not what it means.
Well, I think it was what it meant in 700.
So like an aura.
Yeah. But it was certainly meant something related. But why you would pick an obscure... Well, it's like spelling magic with a K and an E and then a silent P.
Like a dyslexic.
But
my people.
And it's not like the game is full of obvious other old English linguistics or mythological cultural references, you know. Gwendol doesn't feature.
Well, they like a bit of the old Draugr, don't they? That's a classic.
They did, but again, they didn't have anything called... Well, that's
Norse, I
Scandies, know. Yeah, of course you know, sorry. But anyway, odd thing. And then this confused frippin' generations of people coming to early D&D before sort of by about third edition. I think they'd sort of taken it out because it didn't really have anything that confused everyone. But maybe Gary was just proud of his scholarship. But Dwoma doesn't show up in Vance. He used much more interesting words.
It's interesting that you talk about the difference between the D&D changes to the Vance system, because Vance, presumably, correct me if I'm wrong here, his wizards and magicians, I imagine they were fairly competent. They weren't at the start of their career. Is that right?
Yes.
So obviously the classic idea of a wizard is like an old man, presumably he's been practicing magic for ages. And of course the only, not the only, but one of the first stories that leaps to mind when I think about a literary take on the magician starting out is, of course, Wizard of Earthsea. Which we will not get into because we haven't got time. We've got to wrap up pretty soon anyway. But I think she does a very elegant Bildungsroman of a magician. He starts off and he's obviously not... I don't think he even knows he has magic within him at the start. But he clearly grows into some very powerful character later on. But I think... And I think you could possibly turn that into a game, but a lot of the game would be spent not really doing magic. It would be spent basically having adventures and things happening to you, whereas what you're talking about is the D&D version, where the whole point of that system was to immediately get an individual able to practice magic or kind of role play a magician, rather than actually you've got to spend 30 years not really doing magic until you meet a dragon, which, you know, I imagine would have been changed in second edition if that had been how they'd approached it, because it wouldn't have been as much fun as being a barbarian and every time you hit anything you get plus one barbarian points.
So there's a couple of things. I don't want to get into Liguin, we should come back to this later after this meeting, but very briefly, I read a little while ago that one of the inspirations for the way magic works in Earthsea was Liguin was growing up in the US with academic anthropological, I think, parents, I think on the West Coast. And obviously Zen was a topic of discussion in the US in the 60s. So some of the early stuff with Ged and Ogyen, where Ogyen is talking...
But as soon as you say it, that does fit, doesn't it?
And this whole thing, basically you have to sit still and do what you're told for 30 years and you have enlightenment.
Yeah.
It's not far off. Spoiler. And it's a very satisfying sort of arc. Yeah. Very well. The other thing that fascinates me about Ersi, and I read half an interview with her on this years ago, I can't remember, so I'll do some reading before we do another one, is that magic in Ersi is really explicitly sexist. I mean, you know, they've got even got this proverb, weak as women's magic, wicked as women's magic. Mm. And the proper magicians are all men, and all the female magicians are witches or crones or seductresses.
Mm. Quite a lot of them are healers, aren't they? Sort of communal.
Exactly.
Kind of...
So they tend to be either sort of communal and a bit déclassé. Or their proper enchantresses who would leak with the old powers and work in the ruin of men. And Le Guin was, you know, a clearly and thoughtfully feminist writer. And I know that she went back and rewrote the ending of the Ersi books to basically be a bit more explicitly feminist. But it is so interesting to me that this early stage she did that explicitly while she was working this wonderful. You know what? We'll talk about it another day because it's definitely worth another episode. But I was going to say to Vance as well. So he clearly came up working in the merchant marine in the dockyard, travelling the world. And obviously, most of the experience of masculine experience around other men. And there are very, very few female Vancian protagonists. In 60 to 90 books, I can think of one.
Yeah.
And I can think of a couple of others who are sort of point of view character briefly. And one of the reasonable criticisms of Vance's book, and this was a criticism made in the 80s, never mind the 2020s, is that you know, the same is more true of his magicians, and women in the Dying Earth things tend to be crones,
prozzies,
hotties. Mm-hmm. Not usually actually prozzies. They're usually sort of if they're magicians, they're stinky enchantresses, and often there'll be sort of damsels lurking around in Buffy's things, or they tend to be. Forceful middle-aged
aunts. Hence the Woodhouse.
You're right. My God, I hadn't made that connection.
This is explicitly. That's... He said this. The Woodhouse thing. He explicitly says gave him a penchant for overbearing aunts in his own.
And I think most fantasy that is sort of sexist in the way that Golden Age fantasy is. It tends to be just crones and hotties. And I think...
And what's wrong with that?
No, but I think Vance should be commended for adding...
Nobody's allowed to put me into either category, because I'm terrified of what category you might choose.
A third colour to the spectrum, that because you don't get many forceful, characterful middle-aged women. But they still tend to be, obviously, one-note caricatures, like the Woodhousian aunts, you know, they're dragons who don't have scales on the outside.
Though, to be more sympathetic to Vance, because, of course, I don't want to end this podcast by saying he was sexist at the end... it sounds like some of his characters are quite one note, even though they're male. Like
absolutely,
Kugel the clever just seems to run around being a picaresque rogue. Mm. And I've read something about how he's sort of always sympathetic, but only because his plans never come off. Mm. You know, it doesn't sound like he has that much psychological depth or growth as a character. He just sort of
little bit of an arc in the second book, but I think you have to look for that. And again, that wasn't what Vance was doing. He was
that's
a
what I meant. That was all it was.
And there's that he did one.
You know,
of his
it's not like Anna Karenina, and then at the end. We haven't got any progression.
And in other books, there is a bit more psychological complexity. Mm. But again, the point about it is lots of interesting things happen in really interesting places, one after the other. Mm. So you can't keep up. And there's not much room for character development. And
but again, there is room for a lady to take her top off.
I don't think they ever do so on screen, because he was right. There is something... Woodhousian is a really good connection, because often... You know, you get basically ladies going, "Hey, help! Hey, help!" and you know, the protagonist being motivated,
Bertie.
Or you get their beauty being described, or whatever. But it's I don't think you get a sex scene in any of Vance, except in
really
the sort, no. So what you do get,
that's cool.
What you do get is again, I had a skim through Google before this, and they're sort of the Marsh Wefkins, another.
Who are they?
Well, we never know. So the Marsh Wefkins are like sort of calling to Kugel as he walks along the road in the dark.
That's great.
And in the voices of young maidens are saying, "Kugel, Kugel, come and lie with me, and we will not allow any restraint to our pleasures."
I've lost my underclothes. Help me.
But it's
look
very much
them.
this sort of arch way of describing it. Often, you know, with people contorting themselves into ever more luxurious attitudes.
Yeah, that's nice. Own,
but he's it's always quite
That's interesting.
There is one more thing we're going to talk about though before we close. I'm going to show you three Vans. Oddly enough, these are Spanish translations of Vans because I lived in Spain for a bit. My Spanish is quite bad. I wanted to improve it by reading novels, but I wasn't that quite to reading novels in Spanish. So I read Spanish translations of authors I already liked because I reasoned correctly that it would be there'd be fewer idioms I'd have to wrap my head around if it had been translated. Anyway, what's this one called?
Los Deer Deer.
Which in English is, of course, The Deer Deer.
Los Chaschich.
Yeah, and this is?
Well, I think we need to describe this to the listeners. So what I'm looking at is the fifth mutant ninja turtle who was kicked out of the squad for being weird. He appears to be a sort of turtle wearing a green cravat. And I'm sorry to say that the title of this novel is Los Wank.
But it does have an H after the K.
That doesn't help.
No, it doesn't. But this is the thing. Obviously, wank in... Americans know these days what wank means in British English.
Stop saying it.
In the 1950s, Jack Vance certainly didn't. This was a series called The Planet of Adventure, a tetralogy of stories. You know, good pulpy name there, The Planet of Adventure. Each about a particular... It's focused on a particular one of the four non-human races who live on this planet. And one
of
them
the loser turtles.
A word anything with W, the loser turtles. They are quite losery, actually, if I'm correctly. But
I think he's just.
But yeah, it just didn't. It because he was so prodigious, and because it was mostly the American market, it was clearly some time for anybody to push out. You can't buy a book spelt like that anymore.
What it's do they not, call it now?
It's called the Wanek.
But we know.
We know.
I know. Everyone listening knows. Okay. Well, on that note, that intellectual, insightful note. That you have.
Because I love you, I'm not going to finish the podcast by saying having a wanicky day.
Alexis!
Wanek.
I'm going to possibly edit that out. The power.
Yeah. Maiden, crone, or aunt.
Right, well, you at home can decide who the women in your life are, fitting those three totally fair categories. And we will wish you, for now,
a spooky day.